The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
There's a chant in here, I think it's in here, about the reflection on old age, sickness, and death. That's also a good one for cultivating equanimity. Thank you. So I like to talk about things that are difficult for me. Equanimity is difficult for me because when I need to talk about them, then I have to really think about it. So I see this as an opportunity for me to practice as well. So I want to start with a story. This is an obituary that was in the New York Times. I like to read obituaries because I'm fascinated by people's lives. And so this is an obituary of a man who died on December 11th, I believe. He died on the 21st. And he was a Navy pilot in the Korean War. So this is his story. So I think it's a beautiful example of equanimity. On the ninth of my planned 15 bomb runs, at 1,200 feet, an enemy anti-aircraft shell exploded in the cockpit. Instinctively, I pulled back on the stick to gain altitude. Then I passed out. When I came to a short time later, I couldn't see a thing. There was stinging agony in my face and throbbing in my head. I felt for my upper lip. It was almost severed from the rest of my face. I called out over the radio through my lip mic, which was miraculously still worked. I'm blind, for God's sake, help me, I'm blind. The writer of those words, Kenneth A. Schechter, who died on December 11th at 83, was no novelist. A graduate of Stanford and Harvard Business School, he spent most of his professional life as an insurance agent. But on March 22nd, 1952, as a Navy pilot over Wonsan-ni, North Korea, Mr. Schechter, then Ensign Schechter, was the heart of an astonishing real-life thriller, one of the most electrifying air rescues in American military history. Mr. Schechter, then 22, was already an experienced battle pilot. His fateful mission was his 27th over Korea. Stationed on the aircraft carrier Valley Forge in the Sea of Japan, he was a member of Fighter Squadron 194, known as the Yellow Devils, and his targets that day were standard ones, railroad tracks, marshaling yards, and other enemy transportation structures. He was flying a single-seat attack plane known as an A-1 Sky Raider. When the anti-aircraft shell ripped into the cockpit, blowing away the canopy, and he pulled the plane into a climb, he was headed for a cloud bank at 10,000 feet, that would have obscured him from the view of his squadron mates and was probably the gateway to oblivion. Blood was flowing over his damaged eyes and nauseatingly into his throat. His eyes were throbbing, and with the canopy gone, the noise from the engine was ear-splitting. But a scream through the microphone caught the attention of a fellow pilot, Lieutenant Howard Thayer, coincidentally his roommate on the Valley Forge, who spotted him above and gave the order, "Put your nose down, put your nose down, push over, I'm coming up." What followed was a high-tension, high-altitude partnership in which Lieutenant Thayer settled his plane alongside Mr. Schechter's. He would later say that the ensign's head was such a bloody mess he was amazed the man was still alive, and directed him an aerial guide dog with vocal commands back over the battlefront and into friendly territory. Lieutenant Thayer's first instinct was to have Ensign Schechter eject as soon as possible over the water, but the ensign refused. Other pilots had not survived after bailing out into the frigid Sea of Japan, and without his sight, Ensign Schechter, who was fading in and out of consciousness, thought that this was a sure path to death. He mustered the gumption to refuse. The men continued on. They headed for a Marine airfield known as K-18, about 30 miles away. I continued to follow Thayer's directions, but he could see that my head kept flopping down from time to time, and he doubted I could make it to K-18. So he decided to get me down right away, Mr. Schechter wrote. When Lieutenant Thayer spotted a deserted dirt airstrip not far beyond the battle line, he decided to set his friend down there. The ruggedness and brevity of the strip would make it dangerous to use landing gear, Mr. Schechter wrote, so he had to make a belly landing. On went the two planes. From his plane flying 25 feet away from mine and duplicating my maneuvers, Howard's voice was cool and confident, Mr. Schechter later wrote. Reported accounts of the rescue differ slightly, but according to Mr. Schechter's, this is what he heard in his earpiece. We're heading straight, flaps down, 100 yards to the runway. You're 50 feet off the ground. Pull back a little. Easy, easy, that's good. You're level, you're okay, you're okay. 30 feet off the ground, you're okay. You're over the runway, 20 feet, kill it a little. You're settling down. Okay, okay, cut. And then shortly thereafter, jubilantly, you're on the ground, Ken. It was, Mr. Schechter wrote, a perfect landing. Every time I read that story, it gives me goosebumps. So while most of us will probably not be called upon to display that level of equanimity in this lifetime, perhaps we will, I don't know, we will have numerous other opportunities in this life to be equanimous in the face of chaos or change. And these opportunities strengthen our capacity to be equanimous so that we too, like Ensign Schechter and Lieutenant Thayer, can make wise choices so that we can alleviate our own and others' suffering. So I'd like to start this morning with just a definition of equanimity as it's found in Buddhism, and then I'll talk a little bit about where it shows up in the teachings, some of the teachings, and then we can chat about it if you'd like. So the English word equanimity is a translation of two different Pali words, which encompass different aspects of this quality of heart and mind. The first one is one you may already be familiar with. It's the translation that's used in the Brahma Viharas. And the Pali word is upekkha, which means literally to look over. This refers to the ability to observe or to see without getting caught in what we see. So we are able to see the big picture, not just whatever it is we happen to be focused on in the moment. And because we see the big picture, we can be less reactive and we can be at peace. The second Pali word that translates as equanimity is Tatra Maha Tata. Tatra means there or all these things. Maha means middle. And Tata means to stand or to pose. So taken together, Tatra Maha Tata means to stand in the middle of this. It connotes the quality of remaining centered or balanced in the midst of whatever is happening. Certainly we heard that in the story about Schechter and Thayer. So to be equanimous then means that we both have the capacity to see the bigger picture and to remain balanced in the middle of it. In fact, you can think of each as depending on the other. So when we clearly see and understand the truth of how things are, we're better able to remain balanced and non-reactive. So in Buddhism, as you probably know, the truth of the way things are impermanence or change, anicca, the unsatisfactory of everything in life, dukkha, and the absence of a fixed self or non-self, anatta. So when we're balanced, we can remain steady in the face of what are called the eight worldly winds. So those are praise and blame, success and failure, pleasure and pain, fame and disrepute. So we may be getting a lot of praise in one moment, but we don't let that go to our head because we know that in the next breath, somebody may be saying something kind of mean about us. So we can remain equipoised or equanimous in the middle of all of that. Things come and go in this life. Some are pleasant, some are unpleasant, some are neither pleasant or unpleasant. And we can look at all that with interest, but we don't believe that what's happening in the moment is fixed or is going to remain forever or is actually the truth of things in the long run. It's just what's happening now. So there's a Zen story that illustrates this well, and I think this is a really good story for this time of year in Minnesota. So this is a story. A monk in all earnestness asked Master Tozan, "How do you avoid the discomfort of hot and cold?" And Master Tozan said, "Go to that place where there is no hot and cold." And the monk said, "Where is that place?" And the master said, "When you are hot, be hot. And when you are cold, be cold." I find that last part kind of challenging. So, be equanimous even in the face of 26 below or whatever it's going to be tomorrow. I think we've got so many opportunities for practice here in Minnesota. So I'm going to talk a little bit about where equanimity shows up in the Buddhist teachings, and this is just a few of the places. So equanimity has a very important place in Buddhism. It's on many of the lists. You may know that there are many lists in Buddhism. So it's the seventh factor of awakening. It's the fourth of the Brahma Viharas, or what we just practiced. It's the tenth parami, or perfection. And it's also the factor in the fourth jhana, or the state of absorptions. And the fourth jhana is the jhana in which the Buddha was said to have rested in when he was being bothered by the pain in his back or just by the heaviness of the world. So I'll talk a little bit about equanimity in each of these lists and how it's practiced. So we'll start with the factors of awakening. So there are seven factors of awakening, and these are the qualities of mind that's kind of support our journey towards enlightenment. I don't know that I like the word enlightenment so much, but support our journey towards freedom from suffering. The first factor, the factors of awakening, is mindfulness, and mindfulness is the support for the other factors. So mindfulness allows the other factors to arise. The next three factors are called the enlivening factors, and those are investigation, energy, and joy. And they're the factors that keep the mind bright, that keep the body awake, that keep us motivated. If it were all just pain and suffering, right, we wouldn't be very motivated on the path. So these factors help us to be awake and to experience joy. The next three are the calming factors. So those are calm, concentration, and equanimity. And these are the factors that allow us to settle the body and mind and allow insight to arise. So while mindfulness pervades them all and is necessary for them all, it's not a sequential thing, so you don't have to start with investigation and end up with equanimity, but you can use them as needed. So in other words, if you're feeling that you're lapsing into sloth and torpor and that your energy is very low, so that you may want to use investigation or joy or one of the enlivening factors to bring the energy up so that you can continue the practice. Likewise, if the mind is very scattered or busy, then you may want to introduce one of the calming factors, such as concentration. So you might want to focus your concentration a little more precisely. So equanimity is the last of these factors of awakening, and you can think of equanimity as both the culmination of the previous ones and the one that supports them. So just as equanimity is the thing that supports loving kindness and compassion and sympathetic joy in the Brahma Viharas, equanimity supports these other factors of awakening. When they're in balance, when these factors are in balance, there's not too much joy and so that you're feeling agitated, or there's not too much calm so that you're falling asleep. When they're in balance, equanimity arises. And it feels as though the practice were practicing itself. That's a quote from my son. I like that. So maybe you've had that experience where the practice is practicing itself. It's just kind of humming along. That's a nice feeling. So in order to cultivate this last factor in the factors of awakening, it's suggested that one not only develop the first factors, but also that one engage in wise action based on reflection. So specifically, the sutta suggests that one reflect on the temporariness of all beings and things, so the idea that everything changes, that one avoid the company of those who are attached to other beings and objects, that one keep the company of those who are non-attached, and then one continuously incline towards equanimity in whatever posture one may be. So I'll move on to the Brahma Viharas and equanimity in the Brahma Viharas. So we've already practiced equanimity in the Brahma Viharas. That was our first guided meditation. And the Brahma Viharas, as you know, are called the heavenly abodes or the sublime states of mind. And they're sublime because they are kind of the ideal ways that we might conduct ourselves towards other human beings. They're also boundless because the idea is that they are not just directed at the people we like, but that we can extend these feelings of loving kindness or unconditional friendliness or whatever you want to call it towards all beings. So as I mentioned, as in the factors of awakening, equanimity is both the culmination of the first three Brahma Viharas, and it's also the support for their practice. So if you're feeling out of balance, overwhelmed, it's very difficult to have a mind that's full of loving kindness or compassion or sympathetic joy. So equanimity allows us to fully realize the first three of the Brahma Viharas. So Thanissara Bhikkhu is a translator, contemporary translator of the sutras, elaborates on this by saying that equanimity acts as an aid to and a check on the other three. So, for example, when you encounter suffering that you can't stop, no matter how hard you try equanimity to avoid creating additional suffering and to channel your energies to areas where they can be of help, where you can be of help. So one can imagine that Lieutenant Thayer might have become overwhelmed in the face of the suffering of his friend. Right? He looked at his friend's face. His face was covered with blood. He might easily have felt overwhelmed and despaired, which would have rendered him unable to help him. But accepting the truth of what was happening with equanimity, he could see what was happening. He let go of what he might have wanted to be the case. And he focused on what he could change in the moment. And that resulted in his ability to be skillful and to save his friend's life. So that's sitting in the midst of what that I described in the beginning when I was talking about the definition of equanimity. So moving on to the next list, the 10 perfections or paramis. So the 10 perfections are qualities that or perfections of character that we develop along the path. And if you know the Jataka tales, which are the tales of the Buddha before he became enlightened, the Jataka tales are tales about how these different qualities of character were displayed by the Buddha before he became enlightened. And they are qualities or character traits that we can develop ourselves as we practice. So they include generosity, that's the first one, dana, moral conduct or sila, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, determination, loving kindness, and the last one is equanimity. Equanimity always, as you notice, appears at the end of these lists. So the word parami comes from two words. The first is para, meaning to carry one across to the further shore. That's a metaphor that's used in Buddhism. And the second is parama, meaning of utmost importance in formulating the purpose of one's life. So the paramis are these character traits or qualities that both provide the groundwork for how we live our lives, and they also help us to bring us to that further shore, that shore of nirvana, enlightenment, the end of suffering, whatever you want to call it. And equanimity is the last one that supports them. So I'll get to the last list. You may be finding yourself experiencing the calming factors right now. equanimity is the factor that appears in the fourth jhana. Raise your hand if you know what the jhanas are. Yeah. So the jhanas aren't talked about much here anyways, but they show up a lot in Buddhism, and so the jhanas are states of absorption or concentration, I guess it would be the easiest way to put it. And there are four what are called worldly jhanas and four unworldly jhanas. I am not an expert in this. I've practiced them a little bit, but I don't consider myself an expert. I know enough to be dangerous. So I'll describe a little bit of what I know. And so the jhanas are practiced, they're states of deep concentration, and they're practiced not to just have a concentrated mind, but they're practiced so that one can have a concentrated mind so that one can develop insight. And it's a very methodical way of how one practices the jhanas, and there are whole different ways of practicing the jhanas. But the idea is that one develops a deeper and deeper state of concentration so that from that state of calm and equanimity, one will gain insight into the nature of life, basically. And when one's in the jhanas, it's said that one no longer experiences the hindrances, which are sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry and doubt. So when your mind is very concentrated, these hindrances don't show up. And in my brief experience with it, I would say that that's true. When you're really focusing on a particular object, it's difficult for these other things to show up. So jhana, there are different things that show up in each jhana. So in the first jhana, what one's focusing on is piti or joy. So you focus your attention on joy. The second jhana, you're focusing on sukha, or what joy feels like, happiness. And the third jhana, this is one particular methodology for achieving jhana. The third jhana, you're remembering an experience where you had this happiness and joy. And the fourth jhana, you're achieving a state of equanimity. And it's said that the Buddha was in the fourth jhana on the night of his enlightenment. And the fourth jhana is where the Buddha is said to have resided whenever he needed to get away from it all. So I'm guessing that neither Ensign Schechter or Lieutenant Thayer had ever heard of the jhanas. I'm guessing maybe they had. But they apparently both knew something about a non-distracted or concentrated mind, and I would guess that that came from their training, right? They had a different kind of training than we might get in Buddhism, but they knew how to focus on an object. Ensign Schechter, in the midst of great physical suffering, remained present and balanced. He had the equanimity to know that he should not exit his aircraft into the water. So he made a skillful choice then, and he could follow the directions of his colleague, even though he was going in and out of consciousness. Lieutenant Thayer, who was motivated by the desire to end his friend's suffering, focused his mind on the objective of keeping him safe and helping him to land his plane, and he kept in check any of the hindrances that probably showed up. So I'm guessing he had experienced in some anxiety. I'm guessing that he probably felt pretty restless and worried. And maybe he had some doubt that he could even do it. But because of the fact that he could concentrate his mind on his objective, you could say he was in the fourth jhana, and he was able to alleviate his friend's suffering. So I'm kind of taking some liberties here, but I think it works. So I'll just conclude that saying that equanimity is a big deal in Buddhism, and that it shows up many places in the teachings. It's usually the penultimate thing on any list. And there are many paths to practice. So you can practice it as we practiced it this morning in the Brahma Viharas. You can practice it as one of the 10 perfections, or bringing yourself back to a state of equanimity when you find yourself discombobulated in life. You could investigate the jhanas and concentrate on equanimity as a concentration practice. So there are various paths to it, but it is it's considered to be a very important quality along the path. So the Buddha said that the mind is abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will. It is a mind at peace, and I would say that that is a mind with equanimity. I'll end with a quote from Pema Chodron. You are the sky, everything else, it's just the weather. So that's my wrap on equanimity. And so how many minutes? It's about 11:27. Who's in charge here? How many minutes shall we spend for questions?
It's up to you. We can go another 10 minutes.
Okay. All right. So, yeah.
One of the observations that when I think of equanimity, a lot of times I think of total passivity. And I liked your example because I think it connected with kind of wisdom and movement dimension.
Uh-huh.
And I like that.
Yeah. It's definitely not passive. And it's not indifference either. Yeah. It's the place from which we can skillfully act. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
I don't know that everybody's going to know what I'm talking about, but I know you will, so I just have a quick question. Would dialectic DBT be basically equanimity?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So dialectical behavior therapy is a particular type of therapy, is skills training. Mindfulness is a very important component. So again, you see mindfulness as a support for the other skills. And it is about teaching people to be equanimous, to have equanimity in the face of a most strong emotion, whatever's showing up. Yeah, that's a really good description. Thank you. Yeah.
I am discovering a lot of things about myself over certain size here. And I'm getting to a point where actually it's becoming interesting. Distinctions that I'm really feeling, I think it's sort of natural for me, but it has to do with your talk. It's the distinction between the fear of, let's say, criticism and whatever the item is that the criticism comes up. And criticism may go beyond criticism, maybe just the fear of any sort of confrontation, that sort of thing, and the item itself. And I'm discovering how distinct those two are, you know? And I come from a family of my parents were alcoholics. And I think for me, as I kind of process a lot of different things, I think it has a lot to do with that. There's a part of me that wants to seek the peace of appeasement. And because of that, it's very instinctive to me. It makes me sort of fearful of the whole confrontation. And by the way, I'm real good with confrontation, so it's not like I'm all weakling or anything like that. And so as I meditate, it's funny because they're really two different entities. I feel the first one, which actually the whole process of confrontation and all that sort of conflict in there, is more fearful than the items itself. Mm-hmm. And I find that really interesting. And for me personally, I've gotten to a point where I'm just really beginning to recognize that, and it's kind of becoming interesting because I'm not attached to that whole process as I once was. Mm. And there's great liberation in that, actually. But, so it's just kind of an insight.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that.
I'd like to just give an example of how that fit in for me this week. I worked really hard, and I was working with a gentleman. I float all over, so I was working with a gentleman who is very friendly, and I really enjoy him friendly-wise. Working with him, he got a broom pole. It's about that stiff. You know, he's very, very... And how he works. So, trying to find the balance there. By the time I got home, I was extremely exhausted. I just felt like I didn't have anything left to give, anything to do, and I came home and I told my partner that, I said, I don't even feel like I can talk anything. And she says to me, well, is there anything I can do for you? Hmm. And it was the neatest thing for me, because what came out of my mouth is, nothing needs to be fixed. It's just as it is.
Wow.
It was cool. The evening just went on. I wasn't angry. I was wasted in just the way it had to be.
Yeah. Beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Jinxie, for the talk. This year, I'd like to pick up one of the Brahma Viharas, and it is equanimity, just to raise to the surface for a year and to work with it. So I so appreciated this as an introduction. And one of the aspects of my practice that I'm becoming very aware of is in the, whether it's loving kindness, what are the causes of loving kindness or joy or equanimity, and to reflect on that. And even just in this first week of focusing, equanimity has been, I'm realizing is a lot of my suffering comes from a lack of equanimity, and to work with it more thoughtfully is to just take the time each day, and sometimes throughout the day, to look at what are the obstacles. Mm-hmm. To equanimity. And so it may be really little things like, don't respond to the email right now,
or maybe tomorrow, or maybe for a week.
And just the kind of very practical things that allow me to let the emotion quiet and give the space for the wisdom to rise. And so I see it as really hands-on practical, kind of a daily inventory too. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Could you talk a little bit about how to balance equanimity with compassion? I feel like it's looking at it, you said that indifference and equanimity are not the same.
Right. So equanimity allows us to be compassionate without being overwhelmed by the suffering that we may be seeing or experiencing. So reminding ourselves that of the truth of the way things are, that everything changes, that we're all subject to old age, sickness, and death. Whatever of those teachings are helpful to remind you that this is how it is, and that we can't change how it is in the moment. That doesn't mean we can't do something if it seems as though there's something. Sometimes there's nothing that can be done, and to be able to be okay with that. I've lost my train of thought. So it allows us to be with that suffering in a way that's not overwhelming. If that makes sense.
I guess I can say that I was able to apply equanimity to, recollections of the behavior of the people in my family of origin, which was also an alcoholic family. And in that way, rather than blaming and hating and, grinding my teeth about everything that happened, I've been able to just say, well, that's the way it was. And because I was able to get to that point with them, I was able to develop the compassion for them that, they were just human beings hung on the best they could. And they become more dear to me because of was I can't go back and do anything to change it. And even with other people who are in my life now who can be difficult, just to say, well, this is the way they are. And, you know, think about maybe the causes and the conditions of why they are the way they are. But just step back a little bit and not take it personally. And just kind of do a tongue going on the spot.
Thank you. I was very interested in the comments about concentration and focus, because I think in my own practice of equanimity, I feel it's often make the picture bigger, make the picture bigger. Think that, you know, we're all going to die. You know, it seems to me that it's not quite the focus on something when I feel the circumstances that equanimity here is really skillful. It's just making the picture bigger and bigger. So do you see concentration as an element of every practice in equanimity? Or, and I think, you know, quite candidly, I always think concentration is my real Achilles heel in my practice.
Me too. I hate it. And in my experience, it's been incredibly helpful because it helps to calm the mind. Mm-hmm. So even though I don't like it and I'd rather do anything else, it's been profoundly helpful to me just to have a tool to be able to settle the mind so that I'm not just struggling with what is. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that in my experience.
So when you in equanimity practice, do you find an element of that that you really bring your focus to?
In terms of the Brahma Viharas or in terms of a concentration practice? I'm not sure what your question is.
So that you would be practicing equanimity differently, whether you were, say, doing the jhanas or cultivating the factors of awakening,
uh-huh,
or doing the Brahma Vihara practice. You really see those as different equanimity practices?
Well, for me, they are. Okay. I don't know if they need to be, but yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Although a concentration practice could be a good precursor to doing the Brahma Viharas too, you could do in combination. Yeah. Two more minutes. I think I'll end the questions here because I'd like to dedicate the merit, if that's all right. So just settling in. Coming back to the body and to the breath. May the goodness of our practice today together be for the benefit of all beings everywhere. May all beings be free from suffering. May all beings be blessed with equanimity. Thank you for your attention.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.